I'm talking about your arrival and that you were issued with ammunition. And at this point, did you have a firm notion of what the mission was that was in front of you?
No.
Okay.
Still, just that we were going to be combating a guerrilla force.
Okay.
Warfare tactics would be different than, I guess, what we were trained. We knew we weren't going to be against tanks and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
But again, our ranger training, mine.
Mm-hmm.
Would help adapt to this kind of environment very easily.
Had you had much instruction on the way over there as to what was going on in Vietnam? And
we had some historical lessons, people, giving us classes and discussions about the history of what's happened in Vietnam, about the French and their experience in there and
Did that kind of stuff.
So knowledge-wise, give us some idea what we're up against.
Did that help you kind of acclimate to what it was you were supposed to be doing?
I don't know. It was kind of hard. Knowing the tactics on the ground, it was a little different.
Okay.
We didn't really know what the heck to expect yet.
Okay. When you moved off the beach, what happened?
Oh, we moved from Quinon over to Anke, the main division base camp.
Okay.
Set up.
Mm-hmm.
Went by helicopter.
From Quinon to Anke?
From Quinon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they'd come in by helicopters to pick us up and carry us in.
Okay.
Now, my platoon, our helicopter, had a malfunction. As we were lifting off with our company, our helicopter had to abort and come back in and land. I don't know what happened, but we had a malfunction, so we had to unload, and it knocked us out of our order of movement.
Okay.
So with my platoon, I had to pull them aside while the others, they continue with the order of movement, and then bring me back in later that night. So it was not until night that I arrived in Anke with my platoon.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the company, the rest of the battalion was there. And, had no idea where they were because, now we was kind of like on our own.
Sure.
So when finally they got our platoon there, we tried to get everything together, and I'm just out there in the middle of the night trying to find whoever I can, see if they know where our battalion is. So I had to get our platoon moved at night through all these other, and it's just people moving everywhere, just like confusion.
Right.
Find our battalion, get linked back up, and then find out what the heck we were supposed to put up for the night. So that was kind of a that was kind of a mess.
Yeah. That night and also the next few days, what were your first impressions of Anke? What was the state of it when you were there?
We were inside the compound.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so we weren't committed on the line yet. So,
right.
We weren't like directly nose-to-nose. The 101st Airborne Division had a brigade in there that was providing the perimeter security for us.
Okay. And
it was kind of spooky because at night weapons were firing off in the distance. All around us, tracers were going up in the air. It was explosions. We had no idea what the heck was going on.
Really?
I mean, you'd be waking up all every little noise we'd hear.
Yeah.
We didn't know what was going on. Until we could get organized. And then finally, they get us out, and they moved us out onto the perimeter and relieved the 101st.
Okay, how quickly did you guys move out?
Oh, it was a matter of days.
Really?
It wasn't too long.
Really?
And finally, we were out on the defenses looking across the wires and,
And your...
Here we were.
Go ahead, Frank.
No, here we were,
Oh, yeah.
We was on the perimeter, on the front line.
And you were on the perimeter providing defense for the base?
For the base, initially.
Okay, okay. And was that the battalion's assignment?
Our battalion. It was the whole division. So we weren't actually conducting any great offensive operations initially.
Right. So the
we were just getting in country, getting acclimated, getting organized
for
a few days. Yeah.
And once you were actually assigned to the perimeter security, you and your platoon guys took up what kind of position? Can you describe where you were?
Okay, the first time we were committed was over around the Anke airfield.
Okay, uh-huh.
So we dug in positions. Let me see. I think there were already positions there. So it was just like a matter of moving in and taking over and then just making, any kind of improvements to it to enhance the comfort,
Uh-huh.
And we were there, maybe a couple weeks.
Okay.
So, and looking, men on alert, watching for movement at night. It was mainly we were in these static defensive positions around there, prevent any kind of enemy infiltration. And I think a lot of the stuff, in the night, I'd hear movement. Troops would hear movement, and, it was just skittery, nervous type of stuff.
Right.
First being there.
Right.
Not knowing what it's like out there. And the night times were the worst because the bush just moves in a breeze, you know, and they want to open up on it.
And is that pretty much what happened?
Yeah, because, you know, guys' nerves are on edge, I mean.
Right.
It's the first time in real combat that, you know, your life is really, I mean, it's real. Your life is on the line, and just a dog can move out there, and guys would start shooting first.
Mm-hmm. So, and was that pretty much what you were allowing them to do? I mean,
no, we was trying to control it.
Okay.
We was trying to keep it down because one guy panic and shoot at something, not really know what he's shooting at, and everybody else would get on edge, and then, you know.
It just kind of go up from
and
there.
So at times, the whole line could just about open up, and you had no idea. I mean, they're just shooting at nothing. So you had to kind of calm them down, try to get the discipline in them that, you know, make sure you know what you're shooting at.
Right.
Don't, you know.
Were there any actual probes during this couple of 3 weeks that you were out there?
I don't think there were, no.
Okay. Okay. Can you tell us what happened after your perimeter security assignment?
Then, well, we went out and started our first, what we call offensive, where we reached out beyond that wire, you know, and started our airborne, or not airborne, but air mobile operations.
Right.
And I remember the first one we went on as a platoon was called what we call an Eagle Flight. And this is just, you take your platoon, you get about four or five helicopters, load your platoon up, and we go flying around, you know, not any place in particular, and it's like scouting for possible danger or something, for enemy activity, you know. You're out scouting, and I remember we saw something in some clearing somewhere. Something moved, and it was hard to say what. So we said, well, let's go check it out. We went down, landed the platoon, and sure enough, we got into a hornet's nest. In punji stakes, it was the first casualties we took.
Okay. Can
and
you
the
just...
casualties were mainly from the punji stakes.
Okay. Can
platoon
can
sergeant, I know I lost a platoon sergeant then. He took one, you know, in his ankle. Some of the troops got stuck with him. So we started to move, but then the gunfire started picking up.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, uh-oh. We're in over, you know, we might have got in over our heads and talking, you know, and the whole time I got radio contact, company command and all that. So they decided to pull us out, which they succeeded in doing, and we took maybe four or five casualties. Nobody KIA, but just wounded.
Mm-hmm.
They managed to pull us out of that and then, you know, prepped it with artillery and everything and then made a major company size assault in there. Because, you know, the platoon was only like 40-some people.
Right, exactly. Not very many,
so they went in real heavy then.
Uh-huh.
And cleared it out.
Did they have contact, the larger force?
No. By the time when they pulled us out, and by the time they fired the artillery in, the enemy, you know, had withdrawn.
About how long of a time between your extraction and the time that the larger force...
It was a couple hours.
Okay.
And so they had time to pull back. Because when we were a small force in there, and I mean, the Punjis were in there, you know, to get us...
Yeah.
And they were going to try to get us. So we came to the helicopters again, put us in, and got us out. And, of course, on our way out, we drew fire. Some of the helicopters got hit.
Did they?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. So, you know, it was definitely...
they were there.
They were there.
Frank, can you describe the punji stakes and how an actual injury would occur from one of those?
The punji stakes were sharpened bamboo, and they had a way of doing it. They would bake them so they're real brittle, you know, they're sharp and stiff, and long, narrow points. And they hide them in the thicker grass and bushes, and they're hard to see. And they're on a slant, and a lot of them were just small. They weren't, you know, they get you in your lower leg, and they were low. And so if you didn't know they were there, and somebody popped a shot at you, and you started to run, and you weren't looking for those things. But we hit them even before because, you know, guys just walking didn't see them. All of a sudden, they'd go through. And some of the guys, they actually go through their leg all the way through, and they not even realize that it did it. It was so sharp and slick. And then, of course, there's the dirt and everything, so there's the infection.
Mm-hmm.
They have to worry about for treating these things afterwards.
Did you know about these beforehand? Did you know about this as a weapon before you...
Yeah, we knew that they used all kinds of things, yeah.
Okay.
That was first-hand experience on seeing it.
Okay. And you said that several guys actually were injured at that point.
Yeah, we had, I think it was four or five men injured by bungee stakes that day.
Okay. But you didn't lose anyone in that particular exchange?
No one was killed. No.
Okay. That was actually your first...
First contact.
Frank, how did you feel that you did in that situation as a leader? Did you feel you were prepared and handled it well?
I don't know. No, it was kind of tough because we couldn't see the enemy that good.
Right.
Didn't know exactly where he was. Didn't know, no idea how many there were. I mean, you could sense from the fire, but the fire, the group would start shooting in one area and then another area, and it was kind of tough. It was confusing.
Uh-huh. And a little frustrating.
Plus the punges,
Right.
Now you were kind of stuck because you couldn't just move. You were kind of had to stop because, where are all these punges,
So you were extracted out of there by the helicopter.
So we backed up, got on back on the helicopters,
right.
And they pulled us out, yeah.
Okay. And did you go back to Ankay and report?
Right.
What
back
had
to Ankay and gave our initial report and everything.
Now, who did you actually meet with when you got back to the Division HQ?
I know it was company commander, battalion, probably battalion commander.
Okay.
Because now, he was getting the information right as it was happening because we're on the radios.
Yes.
So he's knowing there's actually, so he's already preparing for the attack.
Okay.
But, he's getting the artillery prepared. He's probably, he was going overhead with artillery, and he was getting artillery in there that helped cover us as we came out.
Okay.
And get the enemy off of our back that we can get on the helicopters and get out of there, and then we go back to the rear and just talk to the staff.
Okay.
So he's already on the site. The planning is going, but getting the artillery, getting the follow-up company assault, all that.
Uh-huh.
It just takes time.
He's already pushing that forward.
He's pushing that forward, yeah.
Uh-huh. And you guys were able to rest and recoup for the rest of the day that day?
For the rest of that day, yeah. Our casualties went in the hospital, and then the rest of us kind of just laid back on our gear.
Right.
Smoking cigarettes, going, wow.
Yeah.
It was our first real taste, yeah.
Yeah. Was there a hospital facility right there in Ontario?
Right. We had our division hospital there,
okay.
too.
Okay. Uh-huh. And did you go over and see your guys, or how did that work?
Yeah, we did. Uh-huh. One of them was my platoon sergeant.
Right.
And he had his punji somewhere through his lower, near his ankle and everything. He later come back after they cleaned him and they started to heal. So some of those guys came back. I guess some of them might have got, in the thighs or up higher. I don't know what happened to them. But.
Okay. But your sergeant was able to come back?
But he came back.
Uh-huh. What was his name? Do you remember?
Roy Martin.
Okay. About how long was he out trying to recover?
I think about a week.
Okay. Were those punji sticks treated with anything, do you know? I mean, was there any poison or anything?
Some of the infections are worse than others. Some of them, they said, were treated with, animal dung, and smeared on them.
Right, to increase the infection.
And some of them, a mustard-type agent.
Really?
Because some of these guys would get pierced and they had real big blisters.
Really?
And the word was that there was a mustard agent that was on those punges.
Hmm.
So they would try to contaminate those punges sticks, so that they not only stuck you, but then later would complicate the recovery because of those serious infections, usually using animal dung or something like that.
To compound the problem.
Compound the problem.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever take one of those?
No, I never got stuck with a punge stick.
Okay. After your this initial contact, did you keep going out in the field on these air mobile
operations? Oh, yeah. We'd go out and conduct patrols. Basically, our job was looking for the enemy. We had no idea.
Okay.
We just operate in this area to recon,
move
around and look for signs of enemy activity.
Your area of operation was roughly how far from Ankay at this point?
Well, it depended now, depending on the operation. Some of them would go pretty far.
Okay.
We were generally Central Highlands all the way across.
Ankay, really?
All the way from the ocean, all the way over to Cambodia.
Mm-hmm. Now, in November of 1965, of course, there's the battle that I think Bob Taft was
involved. Big Idring.
Yeah. Did you guys know about that when
No.
it was happening?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
Now, part of our battalion participated in the opening actions
right.
of that.
That's what I was going to ask.
Engagement, yeah.
But it wasn't your company.
No, our company, we were detached from our battalion in early November, and we formed a group called Task Force Amos.
Okay. What was
why our company was picked, but that means, you know, we left. We weren't under our battalion control. We were under this Colonel Amos's control. Yeah, it was an artillery battalion, American artillery battalion.
Uh-huh.
And his mission was to support ARVN operations over on the coastline.
Okay.
So we were separated from our division, had no idea what was going on, not even radio contact with anybody in our division. And we were working with ARVN, and our company mission was to provide infantry security for this artillery battalion. As the ARVN, which was the Army of Republic of Vietnam, that's South Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And they were conducting operations over along the coast, toward Quinion and that area,
uh-huh.
and they were in contact with North Vietnamese forces. Our artillery was firing in support of them. Our artillery FOs would go forward with those ARVN units,
right.
And our artillery FOs were right up there in combat. But where we were sitting around protecting artillery, we were far enough back that we never got directly involved.
Was the artillery arranged in several batteries?
Yeah, there were three batteries.
Okay.
Yeah, a whole battalion of artillery.
And were they stationary?
Well, yeah, basically they were towed, though, by truck.
Okay, uh-huh.
And they were big towed versions.
Do you know what the guns were? Were they
105? 105 howitzers.
Okay. Uh-huh. And you guys were essentially performing, your platoon, your company, were essentially performing perimeter security.
We were perimeter security, just okay. So that the enemy would not infiltrate in the guns and that, you know, in case they would be attacked, that we were there to protect those guns.
How long were you assigned to Task Force Amos?
All the way, about a month.
Okay.
And we missed the whole battle up in the Iodrang.
Okay. Did you hear
about
it?
While we were over there, all that was breaking loose.
Yeah.
And, of course, we had no knowledge that was even happening. Other than there was a hit and miss, that there was some big combat operations up there.
Okay, so that's all you really heard about?
And all, I mean, it was just whatever our company commander could pick up on his radio. Because
mm-hmm.
our battalion was up there, you know.
Right.
The rest of the battalion had been up there. And so we knew that our division was engaged in a major conflict, but we didn't have no idea of the intensity, of magnitude, or anything of it.
How did that make you feel, kind of separated from the other guys?
Well, we were doing our job, so it was like, you know,
okay.
It was everything. So we didn't feel any way, you know,
okay.
Just
mm-hmm.
we were doing what we could do. And we were engaged with the ARVN. You know, we knew the ARVN were in heavy contact where we were.
Right.
Because this was a major push. But we didn't realize this was a major push at that point by the NVA to cut, you know, the South Vietnamese in half.
Exactly.
But we didn't know that. I mean, we didn't have that kind of a perspective.
Okay.
I don't know where we were.
What was your impression? Did you actually see ARVN? Were they around the
battery? Oh, yeah.
Battery?
We saw them. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
We could see truckloads, convoys of them.
Did you have an impression of them, Frank, as military?
At that point, no. Uh-huh. I had no. They were new. We had no idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you have any contact while you were guarding the perimeter there?
No, we didn't.
No probes?
No probes.
Okay. And at night, were there mortars or anything like that?
Oh, our mortars, just ours, but we never came under any kind of fire. We did all the firing.
Okay.
Nothing ever came in on us.
Okay. And you were, again, in this sort of stationary position?
Stationary. We were, yeah, sitting there supporting them. Now, we moved around and relocated those guns at times. But
okay.
To help, you know, as the ARVN advanced,
uh-huh.
you know, to reposition those guns. And we had one interesting experience that I can recall is mm-hmm. we moved at night to relocate these guns. And, you know, total blackout, moving at night.
Right.
And they set these guns up outside a village. Of course, it was dark, so we didn't know too much. We did the best we could to provide security around them. Of course, we never encountered any resistance or anything. And when daylight came, we're looking at the village, and darn, if there's a pole sticking up and a Viet Cong flag flying on the pole. So we decided, you know, whoa, we're close here.
Yeah. That must
so
have been
we moved
a little
in during the night, but we never encountered any enemy. I guess they were probably as surprised as we were.
Mm-hmm. Were you moving through villages?
Yeah, we would drive through villages
right.
in the middle of the night. And again, surprise probably was on our side, because I guess they never expected us to do that. And mm-hmm. likewise, you know. But we only did it one time, I think.
Okay.
So it was not, you know, if we repeated that, I don't know if we'd had such good success each and every time.
Right. The task force was, you were detached from the task force at the end of December, roughly?
After November. It was after the major fighting in Idring.
Mm-hmm.
We were detached from the task force and rejoined our battalion.
Okay. And where did you actually hook up with them?
We hooked up with them back at Onkay.
Okay. And how long did you stay there?
We had Thanksgiving and all that. And
uh-huh.
right after Thanksgiving, I guess we went back up to the Idring.
You did this time?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we went back with the battalion. We went in off on terrain across the river, the Idring River, from where the major
mm-hmm.
X-ray and all that. To continue pursuit of the enemy forces or remnants.
Okay. And at this point, you were much more mobile then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you have a base that you were operating from?
Yeah, well, no, we were operating. Yeah, the base was a battalion base.
Okay. And
it was up there in the Central Highlands there around Plate 2.
Okay. And did the base have a name?
I don't know. I think it was Camp Holloway.
Camp Holloway. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
How long were you based out of there?
Well, it was into December.
Okay.
We were up there through December. I remember spending Christmas up there in Plate 2.
Okay. Can you tell me what happened on
Northern
Christmas?
Northern Highlands. We went back with the battalion back into the Idring in late November, early December.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it was still pretty tense, because then once we got back to our unit, then we really got the word of what happened up there. So when we went in, I know we were tight, uptight, I guess.
Yeah.
Because we expected we were going to have some major heavy contact. We knew there was a large enemy force, a lot of enemy activity in there. But surprisingly, I don't think you even made any. If we did, it was just very light resistance.
And did you reach a conclusion as to why that was, why you didn't?
Well, they had withdrawn.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess nobody really knew. And our purpose, they flew us in hopes to try to cut them off, any of their remnants.
Okay.
But apparently they had already clear back into Cambodia.
So you didn't really come into...
And we didn't come into any kind of major contact. I know in our company, I can't recall, you know, any heavy...
Were there occasional...
There was occasional firefights, but, you know, most of them, I think more was from our uneasiness and jumpiness.
Okay.
We were, on the edge, because we knew they were heavy. We knew the 7th Cav had taken heavy casualties.
Yes, yes.
And so we were kind of really edgy. But we didn't find too much, so we pulled back out of there and headed back to Onkay.
Okay.
We had Christmas up there in Plate 2, I remember that.
What happened on Christmas?
We were all closed in around Plate 2 in the base camp.
Uh-huh.
And just, another day.
Did you get anything special, or did anything special happen?
No, just a meal, nothing special.
Nothing?
I think we were under truce at that time.
Right. There was a Christmas truce. That's right.
There was a Christmas truce, and we were pulled back, and we weren't running any operations or anything, just enjoying the time. I know we did some practice parachute jumping and stuff like that.
Now, after this respite, let's say, at Christmas,
uh-huh.
did you're based again now at Onkay.
Yeah.
Did you deploy out of there at some point?
We went back to Onkay, and then... We conducted operations, I can't remember exactly, just operations here, there. There was nothing major, I don't think, you know, I mean, we'd made contact, you know, just light,
uh-huh.
minor contact, off and on.
I think in the forms you described an incident where there was, where your men were deployed over three different hills, and you're pulling them back. Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, that was earlier, though.
Oh, okay. Well,
that was earlier than that. That was still like back in...
When you first got over there?
We first got over there shortly afterwards.
Could you describe that?
Up on this mountain called Nui Hong Kong?
Yes.
They had an outpost position, and my platoon was designated to go up there and provide security for an artillery outpost they had up there.
Mm-hmm.
And it overlooked the valley, and it was on, there were three peaks on this mountain. And so when he deployed them, it deployed each squad. There's three squads in a platoon, on each squad on a peak.
Mm-hmm.
So we was providing the security to keep the enemy from, if he'd come up there, and then he couldn't get any one of these peaks. They weren't that big. I mean, you know, 10 men could fit on there pretty easily. But if you get more than that, you got a crowd.
Right.
So anyway, when we got the day, we got the orders to pull off. Nothing happened, no incident or anything. And I guess we were up there about a week. And it was just, at night, something would move in the bushes, and guys would get jumpy about it. But nobody ever shot at us or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the day they told us to assemble, pull the platoon back, they were going to lift our platoon off and bring another platoon up from another unit and replace us. So I called my squads back off the knolls to the one that I was on, where the helicopter LZ was,
mm-hmm.
and had everybody just kind of sitting around and waiting for the helicopters. And since we hadn't had any kind of activity, I mean, it was like, this is just another day in a park out here for us. So I took off and decided to go check these other positions, make sure, troops picked up all their stuff and weren't leaving any of their gear behind to do an inspection.
Right.
They weren't leaving anything behind. And I walked down a path, down through like a little draw, and back up the other side. And I was walking underneath this tree, and I heard a bolt-action rifle. Just like, click, 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 as the round was being chambered. And it dawned on me that, that was a bolt-action rifle. About that time, I just dove for the ground. Dove backwards, and the sniper shot, and he missed me, thank goodness. So I've sprayed my gun, and I only had my gun and one magazine of ammo, because I had left all my other gears back there with the troops, and I emptied my gun in the tree. I didn't see, I didn't know. All I heard was the shot. So I was laying there with nothing. Well, the machine gunner opened up, helped out a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and this guy jumped out of the tree and got away. It was a sniper to come up there as we pulled back, was waiting. So
he had he definitely had an opportunity to.
So as we pulled out, I guess the guys had been there watching us all this time.
Probably.
And he climbed up in that tree, and none of us saw him do it until I walked over there. But when I got underneath the tree, fortunately, I don't know why he didn't have a round in the chamber, but that I could hear that bolt move in that rifle and jump. Just the time I guess he was squeezing the trigger, squeeze that round off.
Do you know how close that round came to you?
Oh, it hit the ground right between my legs.
Did you saw him jump out of the tree?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I had rolled on my back. I had just emptied my rifle full automatic in the tree, not knowing him, not seeing him.
Right, just.
And then I started rolling again because I was afraid he was going to shoot again.
Sure.
And the machine gunner, the guy was sitting over on the other knoll about maybe 30 yards away, 30, 40 yards away. Saw him and opened fire, over me. And
yeah.
I was still laying on the ground. He was shooting over me. And of course, he was shooting kind of high because he didn't want to hit me, so he didn't hit the VC either. And he said he got away. He ran down in the woods and got away. So I beat Pete back over to the platoon. And I said, man, that's enough of that.
yeah. And you learned a few things.
Well, I learned, because, never walk away from you, leave your ammo. Like I did, I left all my ammo sitting there. All I had was that one clip in the rifle.
Right.
Never get separated from that.
Because you have no idea what you're going to...
You have no idea when, where, or what you might encounter.
What was the machine gunner's name who helped you out?
I can't remember what his name was.
Okay. Did he describe the guy at all?
He didn't get a good view. All you can see are more forms. When you're moving like that, it's just you see the form. You can't get a clear picture. Guys, black outfit, and that was it. So quick. It was just like a matter of seconds.
And you were pretty much ready to get on the helicopter.
Sure. I mean, after that, I was glad to be alive.
That incident really stood out in my mind, so I thought I'd be sure to ask you about it.
Yeah.
In the new year, then, in 1966, the platoon was asked to do what kind of duties?
Well, we did what they call search and destroy.
Mm-hmm.
As part of the company, they assign areas of operations, and times we'd move independent as a platoon, and other times we'd operate with the company. And most of this stuff is just walking around through the mountains and the jungles and just looking to see what, you know, see if you could find anything that indicated any kind of enemy activity.
And what was the protocol if you did actually encounter people? Were you supposed to just were you supposed to actually engage them, or were you supposed to call for help, or what were you actually instructed to do?
No, it was out in these combat zones. It was anybody out there was enemy.
Okay.
And you fired first if you could.
Okay.
But usually it never worked that way. They always fired first. Because
mm-hmm.
normally we're moving around. We don't know where we are. We're out there beating the bush. And these guys, you know where the trails go. It's their home.
Right.
And, I mean, you know, and they can hear you. So usually they're always tipped off or alerted. I mean, as we fly in with helicopters, they know you're coming in. So they're always tipped off that we were there.
Right.
So they could either avoid us or, you know, try to set up an ambush us any chance they get. And usually it was always they would fire first. Now, around the villages, yeah, we had to be careful. You know, there the rules were different. You know, you couldn't shoot first. You had to wait until you received fire.
What was the attitude of the guys in the platoon? How were they doing morale-wise with this kind of operational setup?
Well, initially, you know, they were gung-ho, but then they were okay morale-wise. It was
mm-hmm.
just, why are we here, though, you know? That was the big question, you know, what are we doing?
What answer did you have?
Oh, you know, we're here to serve in our country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's our job.
Did you...
And a lot of times it was just point-blank, you know, because you don't have any other choice.
Right. And did you have to do that sometimes? Just tell them, you know, just get on with it?
Yeah. Say, you know, whatever reason it is, you're here, you know. And whatever reason you're here, you've got a job to do, you know. You just can't walk away from it. There's no walking away.
Right. Did you spend any time thinking about why the United States was there?
Yeah, I wondered myself.
Okay. And did you get any, reinforcement or... support or information on that question that helped you kind of resolve your...
We wondered why, you know, if it, anything we were doing there, if it really doing any good, because it was tough. I mean, you know, the civilians, we weren't winning the civilians over. That was no doubt.
Even at this point, you were...
They wouldn't tell us. We'd go in, and, I mean, they would withhold information. They wouldn't tell us where the boot, you know, we'd ask for information, you know, where booby traps are, you know, where VCR are. They wouldn't tell you nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd walk, and we'd trip booby traps, and we'd get people hurt and killed. And we'd get angry at the civilians.
Right.
Why didn't you tell us, you know? But now I look back, and, hey, you know, we're asking these guys to tell us their brothers, their husbands, you know. Where are all your men, you know? We want to go kill them.
Right.
And the VC, were their sons, they were their husbands, these villagers.
Very difficult position.
And not realizing, that they were in that kind of a, you know, it was part of ours that, hey, you know, these people live here, and, you know, and they serve both sides. And, of course, they were more fearful of the Viet Cong and the communist part because they paid a terrible price. They didn't obey those orders. Of course, they didn't tell us, you know, we were under our rules and we weren't going to hurt them,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, we weren't unless we had somebody go off the deep end. But they knew that they can lie to them. That's the thing today, you know. We're the nice guys and we're not going to hurt them. So they can lie to us. And we're not going to come in the middle of the night and shoot them in the head or something.
Right. Did you guys make much contact during early 1966 on these search and destroy operations?
Not off and on, just light contact,
uh-huh.
scattered resistance until the big Operation Crazy Horse operation in May.
Okay. Before we talk about that, Frank, can you tell me a little bit about what you were learning as far as the terrain and the trails and whether your guys should be on a trail or off a trail?
Right. No, we were learning a lot about that. Yeah.
Okay.
Those trails were dangerous.
Uh-huh.
We didn't know. We don't, you know, it wasn't our trail. Walk those trails was deadly.
Because why?
Well, number one, you know, it's their home. Mm-hmm. They can watch the trails. They can see you. And we're the ones having them moving around. And number two, they're pretty good at booby traps and hiding those things. And those trails channelized you. They could ambush you easy enough. Because then they knew exactly where you were. So mm-hmm. by staying off the trails, you weren't committed to any, you know, any one place where they can really lock you in tight, you know, and trap you in. And also, you can't go out and booby trap the whole world, you know what I mean?
Right.
You booby trap those likely places, and so you could avoid miss a lot of the booby traps. Matter of fact, you felt more secure out in the jungle because, you know, you're in the middle of the jungle. Who's going to walk way out here and put a tripwire in the middle of nowhere?
It just felt less likely that there would be a trap there for you.
But along a trail or, you know, something like that,
mm-hmm.
You can set a booby trap. If somebody's walking longer, you can trip it. So, you know, I've always felt, you know, more secure out in the middle of the jungles, just wandering and try to avoid those trails. Those were danger areas.
And typically, can you describe how you would deploy your platoon? You had men out on the left and right, and presumably someone on point. Can you describe that configuration, how you generally would operate?
Yeah, that would be it. Mainly the point man. It was the key. He was always moving ahead of you, alerting that way if he ran into anything, because the jungle was so thick you couldn't see very far.
Right.
So he'd be out in front, and if there was something, he would, you know, call you to a stop before you get your whole platoon out there exposed out in an open area or up close to a trail or something, you know, where they might get shot or trip a booby trap. Again, though, the point man's job was pretty hairy.
Yes.
Because he's out there, and you'd have to change him off every so often.
How many guys did you have who were actually point men?
Everybody had to pull the tour out there.
Okay. And did you have greater confidence in some guys?
Yeah, some guys were better. I mean, they were more adept. You know, it's like hunting. Some guys have that sense,
yeah.
You know, and they're better than others. And again, I guess some guys would volunteer, if I recall, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Because they didn't want to trust somebody else.
Right, right.
Because they want to trust their own senses and not leave it up to somebody else and try to do that.
Where would you have been as the platoon?
I always moved basically behind the first squad.
Okay.
And that way, if they run into contact, generally I wouldn't be right in the middle of the fire.
Now, who would stay next to you? Who would stay near you?
Okay, I would have RTOs by me. Uh-huh. I'd have a medic by me.
Okay.
Or the medic would be back by the platoon sergeant, but I'd have the radio communications.
Okay.
So I could talk to the company, you know, call for artillery, talk to my squads. And so I would try to stay back behind that first squad.
Okay.
That way, if they encountered anything, you know, and I was free, I could be free that I can, you know, try to look, see, evaluate the situation, talk on the radios, move other squads around, and maneuver the unit and not get pinned down where I'm, you know, fighting for my life.
Right. And you're keeping your men safe as well by
manipulating. Trying to keep them safe and get the artillery fire in and all that kind of stuff that they needed.
Right.
Of course, it took a while to do that. You want to be a hero, you know, a young guy, and you're trying to follow me, you know. But then you find out, I mean, just found out that really you don't do much good if you're out there in front and you get shot down.
Right, your responsibility is greater.
If you can get them to get the fire in for them, maneuver, get it, you know, and that's your job.
What kind of radio equipment were you actually using?
We had what's called the PRC-25.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty good radio. That radio was. The squad radios weren't any good.
We
would have a PRC-25 with each squad, but again, you know, the power of that radio was more than what you needed to talk to your squad, but the squad radios just simply didn't work. They'd get wet, they'd get banged around, and they just flat didn't work.
Oh, that sounds pretty dangerous. What did you do to make up for that? Was there anything you could do?
No, we used those, the PRC-25 radios.
Oh, okay.
These are the big, heavier radios,
yes.
Though.
Mm-hmm.
But we talked to our squads like that.
Okay.
And they had them. We could get them. I don't know how the heck we got them, but we got extra radios, so.
Okay.
We could equip our squads with them.
Uh-huh. Did your platoon, first of all, have a particular call sign that you were operating under?
Yeah, we were left end 3-6.
Okay. Can you describe how that got assigned to you? Or?
Well, it just got assigned, and let's see. Our company was left end,
mm-hmm.
Then let's see, the other companies was left guard, I think right guard, left half, you know, they used the football positions in the battalion,
uh-huh.
And that was kind of our call sign the whole year.
And 3-6 was what?
3-6, the 3 standing for the 3rd platoon,
okay,
and the 6 meaning leader, the commander.
Okay. Did your guys encounter booby traps, and did you have any injuries from that during this time period?
Oh, yeah.
Did you lose anybody?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Those are ugly.
Yeah. When something like that would happen, did the other guys kind of gel together more, or would you say there was greater fear
I don't know. We would gel. We would run to the aid, or basically we'd spread out. But mainly, you just can't run to the aid. You get the people in the immediate area who weren't hurt. We try to get the casualty.
Right.
Usually, it was like a blown leg or
arm.
I mean, seldom would someone get killed by one of these things.
Right.
But
horrific.
It would be devastating. It'd blow a foot off, or that's serious enough. Try to get medical aid right away, immediately. The rest of us would just take up a perimeter, in case we didn't come under attack. But of course, generally there was nobody out there. These things were left, and whoever put them would be gone.
Right. And say you were in deep jungle, and this kind of thing happened. How did you get a seriously wounded guy to medical care?
Well, you'd use that penetrator, the cable, the helicopter hover over the trees. Put the jungle penetrator, come down and strap the guy in there,
Okay.
The medics would get the bleeding under control.
Right.
And then you strap him into that penetrator, and they would pull him up through those trees.
And you would call for dust off, basically?
Right. You would call right away, try to get one inbound as fast as you could.
And did you have an opinion of the guys that were flying those missions?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me how you felt about that.
Oh, Lord bless them.
Yeah.
I mean, those guys would stick, themselves, their necks out to aid a wounded soldier on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And, they put the aircraft at risk, but they would do it. And I imagine a lot of them did crash and probably cost them some lives, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But to reach out just to help a wounded grunt,
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't say enough about them.
Frank, can you tell me about what happened during Operation Crazy Horse? What role did you guys have in that operation?
Now, we were with Bravo, Charlie Company, initially.
Uh-huh.
So we flew in there. I don't know if you've read that story yet or not. Have you seen it?
Which one, sir?
For Crazy Horse?
No, I don't think so.
On our battalion website and all?
Oh, I did read a diary, yes.
Under B Company and
yes,
C
sir.
Company. Yeah.
Yes, sir. But can you go ahead and describe it for people who won't have access to that?
Well, our companies went in there, and
uh-huh.
I'm in Charlie Company, the first night into LZ Crazy Horse. We moved out on a high ridge line. There was another unit in there. It was either 5th Cav, I think it was 5th Cav, maybe, that had been there in heavy contact for a few days. And we were, relieving them.
Mm-hmm.
They were coming out, and we were coming in. We were fresh, and they'd been there fighting for a couple of days. So they were pretty haggard and tired. And we moved up onto a ridge line and kind of stayed on that ridge line that first night. And the next day, we moved as a company along there. We'd encountered some resistance, made some light contact. The lead elements did. I was in the 3rd platoon, and we were following the 2 lead platoons
mm-hmm.
in the company. And we linked up with Bravo Company in a valley. There was a creek down there. And Bravo took the lead and stayed in the valley and started to move up toward another hill. And we were moving up on our side. We were left of them on that creek to try to protect them from the higher ground. And Bravo ran into the heavy resistance, the B Company did,
mm-hmm.
as they approached that hill. That's where Lieutenant Crum and their 1st Platoon took pretty heavy casualties. So we had stopped in C Company, and we had dug in and prepare a base or something they could fall back on and start to open an LZ and everything to try to get relief in there.
Right.
And so B Company was carrying a fight. Well, then they had one platoon that was pinned down. A platoon leader was killed, so Bravo Company commander asked for help. Captain Mosey, RCO, ordered my platoon to go over and link up with B Company and assist them. So I moved my platoon out And it was heavy resistance. I mean, we could hear the 50 caliber machine guns. You know, first time I ever heard those things in combat.
Mm-hmm.
Those things was bad sounding.
Yeah.
So we moved over. I mean, it wasn't hard to find B coming because all you had to do was move in a direction of that noise, the guns and those 50 cals that were firing at them. And, you know, we found B coming. Mm-hmm. Got on their right side and started up the hill. Of course, the 50 cals, which, you know, those things would hit those trees. I mean, wood would just splinter and fly. Those are big bullets.
Yes, sir.
And we took some heavy casualties. You know, we lost a couple of soldiers right out the bat. And a couple of our guys had some heroic actions. You know.
Do you remember any of those that you could describe?
Well, yeah. Michael Vanessa.
Mm-hmm.
And he got killed there, holding his ground. He's trying to take out an enemy machine gun position to help out, and got shot in the process. And Michael really didn't have to be out there. He was due to rotate shortly, and he asked for permission to come out on this operation with us. The other one was David Jolly, who was a machine gunner in my platoon,
mm-hmm.
and he took a bad hit, got killed. He didn't die outright, though. Michael did, and David Jolly took a shot through the chest, you know, and pretty bad shot.
Yeah.
Operating machine gun. He lived and died sometime during the night because, you know, it was dark and stormy rain. We couldn't get him medical evacuation, and he just didn't make it through the night. And did everything they could to try to keep him alive.
Mm-hmm. Sir, did you put either of those men in for a commendation?
Oh, yeah.
Any kind?
They both got, I think they both got Silver Stars.
Okay. And did you oversee that and initiate that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because those two, by their actions. Sampson, Jimmy Sampson,
mm-hmm.
he's another one. He got a Silver Star.
What and happened?
In the midst of all that, he just resisted until he was shot down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these guys were instrumental. Each of them, though they became, were wounded or killed, I mean, by holding their ground in position, and by putting the fire, and what they did do is they broke, you know, the enemy positions.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they suffered. They didn't back away. They stayed there. They held their ground. They returned fire. They did all they could, and, you know, and their actions contributed greatly to defeating the enemy on that hill.
And helping to protect the rest of B Company as
well? Well, trying to get B Company extracted and by mm-hmm. driving the enemy off the hill. Now, see, they were dug in on the high ground there. They're looking down at us. We're having to crawl up this thing.
Yeah.
So
about how far away were they? Can you?
Oh, we were almost could reach out and touch them at times. We'd gotten right up almost, you know, hand-to-hand.
Were your men able to take out one or more of those 50 cal machine guns?
Well, they abandoned them.
Okay.
Sometime during the fight, the 50s just ceased firing. So, mm-hmm. you know, the fire we were putting on them eventually, and later the next day the guns were sitting there, abandoned. They were dead, and, you know, the enemy dead was around, but I don't know if we killed them all, but.
Mm-hmm.
Those guns were still there. We were able to capture those guns. How and when those guns, you know, I don't know exactly when.
But you know, that's a major accomplishment, getting
but they, yeah,
those
they
deadly
got, we
weapons.
Got the fire stopped. I mean, if they were okay, they could have just picked those guns up and carried them
sure,
away. So
that's
I
right.
imagine we did some damage, yeah.
Yes, sir. How many men did you lose in that?
The two dead,
mm-hmm.
Michael and Jolly. Numerous wounded. I can't recall exactly.
Where was Michael from? Do you remember?
California.
Okay. And David?
David Jolly is like Michigan or something.
Uh-huh.
Midwest.
The next day, your enemy has basically disappeared.
Yeah.
What did you do that morning?
Okay. After that fight the day before with B Company. It was dark, late into the night. It was into the nighttime before things became secure, before
okay.
we got the hill.
Uh-huh.
Bravo Company got up on top of the hill, Captain Martin and all them.
Okay.
Were able to reach the crest of the hill. He called to us, and we'd ceased fire because, you know, his troops were up there. So, and then we were ordered to back off and return to Charlie Company
mm-hmm.
for the night.
Mm-hmm.
And we pick picking up our wounded. Of course, you know, the wounded were being assembled at the base of the hill, and there were numerous of them.
Okay.
And we might have had 10, 12 wounded men laying down there. Platoon sergeant had gathered them together.
These are men in your platoon?
And men in our platoon, and the medics were down there. Mm-hmm. And they were from the B Company, too.
Okay.
So they had gathered a whole big cluster of men that were wounded.
Yes.
And so we went back to our company, brought those men back that night. That's when Jolly died. Of course, Jolly was alive when we brought him back.
Mm-hmm.
But he was hurt bad.
Really bad.
And he was still alive. We brought him back, same up there. The medics tended to him all that they could during the night. He just died during the night.
Mm-hmm. It was, I'm sure, a massive wound.
Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah.
And it was through his chest, you know, right his throat, down through his chest. And the other guys were varying wounded, you know, arms, legs, stomachs. Most of them were able, and most of those men could walk back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those wounds were more flesh wounds, and they weren't that serious, so they were able to walk back.
And your sergeant was assembling these guys?
And the sergeant was assembling those guys.
Uh-huh. And had he been hurt at all?
The platoon sergeant? No.
Right.
No, he hadn't been hurt.
And what about you? Were you okay?
Yeah, I was okay.
Uh-huh.
So I was fine. I was unwounded.
Okay. And did helicopters come and get the men out of there?
No.
Okay.
We were in the middle of these jungles. There was no clearing.
No clearing?
No clearing.
Okay.
And that was the reason that it was raining. So, you know, visibility was poor.
Mm-hmm.
It was dark. And we couldn't get them in there. So we kept those casualties, you know, and the medics were working on them as best they could during the night. And the next day, we secured the area. I was part of the security process for B Company. The rest of the C Company went back up on the hill, back to where we had just pulled back from.
Okay.
And they're the ones, you know, Cat Mosey and them went up there, and they found all those the machine guns abandoned and stuff, you know.
Uh-huh.
They found all that stuff. And so Captain Martin was taking care of the evacuations, and I was just providing security, you know, moved my platoon over around the area, and they cut down some trees and started to evacuate the more seriously wounded people who were alive. And all of it was being done by winch. You had to winch them out.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. It was taking a lot of time. It took nearly, I think, the whole day to do this. Get the casualties out, and then finally, you know, those who had died, not you know, R2 plus any of the others from B Company who had died, like Lieutenant Crum, you know, their first platoon had many casualties. They had a lot of KIAs to it.
Uh-huh.
And get all of those casualties pulled out of there. And we did that without incident, you know.
So the enemy really had just completely abandoned the
area. And Cap Mosey had gone up the hill and found all their positions. They had just simply abandoned them. They were all bloody and
mm-hmm.
buried. There were some of the dead that they had buried up there.
They had buried them?
They had buried them, yeah.
Uh-huh.
In you know, all their gear, 50 calibers and 30 caliber machine guns.
Right.
So apparently they had taken a pretty good pounding, and so they finally just abandoned their weapons and ran.
What would have, on a day like this, what would have happened to the enemy dead? Did you just leave them there, or what?
We just left them there.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Did you would the commanding and the intel people may have?
Well,
looked
them over? You know, the area would have been marked, identified at the battle, and
mm-hmm.
we just simply left them there.
Okay. Okay. And when were you actually able to extract the rest of your platoon from that area? Did you stay there a while?
No, we continued operating.
Okay. You
even though we'd taken casualties.
What was your strength at this point, then?
I don't know. We were whittled down, you know,
yeah.
to maybe 30.
Okay.
Or maybe less than that.
Uh-huh. But they left you in sight, and you just kept moving around.
We stayed around. There, yeah, continued to operate. We moved to make contact to see if we could make contact with that
okay.
enemy force yet.
Did you ever find them again?
No, we never did find them again. Of course, when they beat feet, I mean, they knew where they're going.
Yes, that's right.
We couldn't kind of just go running after them.
That's right.
We have to spread out, and I mean, you know, we move slow and cautiously, and so they packed their bags and left.
Now, did you have a sense of whether these were VC or NVA?
I think they were NVA. The sense was, yeah, the
mm-hmm.
weapons they had, how heavy,
right.
The amount of resistance, the dug-in fortified positions, their determination to stay and not, you know, to fight.
That was all?
That all indicated NVA.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, disciplined hardcore unit. The VC were ragtag. They would fight fiercely for a short period of time, you know, after 30 minutes, an hour, and it's over.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, I mean, we were fighting for hour after hour. against these guys.
And that was just a completely different game.
Different,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
I mean,
feel to it, different touch, yeah.
Yeah.
Plus the heavier weapons. I mean, you just can't lug these 50 calibers around on your back. You know, these are heavy weapons.
Right. Sir, at some point you had an R&R. Can you tell me where that was?
Yeah, I went on R&R to Hong Kong.
Was it before or after the Crazy Horse operation? Do you remember?
It's hard to remember now. Yeah. Hard to sequence these things. I mean,
yeah,
I can remember events and then put them in the right time sequence. So, probably before.
Okay.
I think it would be before.
Took
a break.
How did your R&R come about? Did you have to apply for it? Or
No, somebody, you know, said, okay, you know, we've got an R&R, go there. Mine was Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody want it? Usually you try to make sure, you know, as a leader, you want to make sure all your troops got first cuts.
Right.
So, I guess nobody wanted it, so I said, well, I'll take it, you know.
Okay, and how long did you get to be away then?
What was the R&R, 7 days, 7 nights?
Uh-huh.
You know, a week away.
How did you actually get out of the field?
Well, you get on a helicopter.
Okay.
You leave your troops there under the platoon sergeant, and they continue operating.
Right.
And you just jump on a helicopter, go back to the rear area, get cleaned up, put on a clean uniform, go down to wherever the main, you know, like Cameron Bay or wherever they were flying you out of and check in.
Okay. And is that what happened? Did you get a plane at Cameron?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, I guess it was somewhere like that, one of those major airfields.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you tell them where you're going and everything, and they say, okay, you know, they clean you up and give you all these rules and don't do this, don't do that.
Uh-huh.
And put you on a commercial airplane out of there. You fly.
So you arrived at the airport in Hong Kong.
Yeah, that was fascinating coming in there.
Yeah, tell me about that.
If you ever knew that. Coming in like between these mountains,
mm-hmm.
and that runway kind of sticks out in the bay.
Yes, sir.
And all these buildings, you know, you're like flying right between all these buildings coming into that thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was neat. I can still remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And looking up at those mountains.
Yes, it's a beautiful place. What were your impressions of Hong Kong when you first arrived?
I don't know. I guess just dazzled.
Really?
Because I'd never seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
I've been in Pennsylvania, and I mean, I've been in a couple of cities, but wow. Millions of people.
And hugely busy.
Busy, busy, busy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, I'll tell you.
Well,
I don't know.
What did you do for
well,
7 days?
We did some shopping.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, you know, the idea was went shopping, and I know bought gifts for my family back home.
Mm-hmm.
These shops apparently, you know, these were good buys and everything. So did all that, bought me some clean clothes, stuff, civilian clothes.
Right.
Where ate, you know, drank, went to the bars,
uh-huh.
drank some cold beer and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Where did you actually stay? Did you stay?
I can't remember
hotel?
The hotel. One of the hotels. I don't remember.
Okay.
The hotel.
Okay.
It was already booked in there or something. So.
Oh, you just kind of kind of slide into wherever they had you set up.
Yeah, wherever they have, and they say, yeah, okay, uh-huh. and they go in and check in and everything and give you a room.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Sure. Did you enjoy yourself, or was it hard to separate from the situation and your men?
I enjoyed myself while I could.
Okay.
Enjoyed. I went sightseeing. I took that ride up the mm-hmm. side of that mountain and the trolley.
Mm-hmm.
Went to the gardens way up high, did sightseeing, what I could sightsee.
Did you take a camera with you?
Yeah, I had a camera, but I don't have too many pictures now. I don't know what's happened to them.
But
it was just a cheap camera, too. It wasn't a real good one.
Right.
I think I probably picked it up. And I remember I had some pictures. I can remember. I don't know where they are now.
So you were basically being a tourist.
Yeah, more of a tourist, eating out at some fancy restaurant every
uh-huh.
night. Yeah, going to the bar. Probably getting drunk.
Uh-huh.
Go back to the room, go to bed.
Right. And did you feel you were able to relax a little?
I don't know. I don't really think so, no.
Okay. Uh-huh.
No, I don't think so. Because you knew this was just like a dream. It's not lasting.
Yeah.
And you knew that you still had time left in country. So this was just a short break.
Did you think about your guys and wonder what they were up to?
No, I don't know if I did or not. No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
What about going back? Can you describe how you felt, or do you remember now?
It wasn't, you know, it's like something you dread, but you know you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't get out of it.
So you just got on with doing it.
You know you got to do it. You wish you didn't have to, but
right.
it's your obligation to do it.
When you returned and saw your guys again and stuff, do you remember, were they happy to see you, or were they like, you know, did they razz you a little bit about
it? Oh, they razz you. Yeah, they want to know, you know, tell us what you did.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, give us all the details.
Yeah, right. after Crazy Horse and that and the operation that you continued on afterwards,
yeah.
What happened to your platoon next?
Let's see. We come out of that Crazy Horse operation, and yeah, it's just wherever they sent us, here and there. Every day, I mean, you were out looking, you know,
uh-huh.
you're hunting.
Uh-huh.
And every day was not, you know, there was not always contact every day.
No.
You were out there, you were looking for signs of the enemy, and many, many days, just, it's like a walk in a park, like I call it. Nobody ever shot at you, you didn't find nothing, you're just beating your way, you know, like, here I am beating my way through the jungle, fighting the ants,
mm-hmm.
and all the insects, and everything else, and nothing. When those days were okay, you know, you could settle down at night, nobody shot at you, and you go to sleep, wake up the next day, and, you know, still there.
Right, right.
You shouldn't complain, but then, you know, the thing is, though, is as you go day after day after day after day, you get lax, you know, you get lackadaisical.
Mm-hmm.
Your guard starts coming down, you're not as alert, as keen, and that's when you let your guard down. And it seems like they always knew when you were at your most vulnerable, is when they hit you, catch you, when your guys are goofing around, and, you know, they're not carrying their weapons with them, they're leaving their weapons lay on the ground.
Did something like that actually happen, where your guys were, you know, not as alert as they could have been, and something?
No, there were times. I can't remember any specific, but yeah, mm-hmm. sometimes. That's yeah. you know, you get a sniper shot. Somebody takes just one shot at you, and that's it.
Right.
It hit somebody. So you knew this guy's been watching you.
Mm-hmm.
And
then
here you are looking, and this guy's camouflaged, and you know he knows the terrain better than you do, and they're keeping an eye on you, and you know it. When something like that happens.
And after that, of course, then you're completely on...
Well, yeah, they put you back on your guard again, and then nothing happens again, you know?
Right.
And they keep you keyed up that way.
After Crazy Horse, did you get new men into the platoon to...
There were new men coming, you know, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
One or two, you know, just... And I guess our strength, because, you know, you were fighting malaria...
Mm-hmm.
Guys were getting sick. They were getting injured accidentally. You know, sometimes it was just a punji stake would get somebody. You know, somebody get stuck with a punji stake. There'd be no enemy contact or whatever, and just sores or sickness.
Uh-huh.
But you were losing men, and so we had it. There's always new men coming in all the time.
Yeah.
It wasn't every day, but you know.
Right. How did the how did the new guys how were they treated at first, or did it vary by personality?
They were, you know, the problem was the older guys, the guys that were seasoned, looked at them and says, you know, you knew guys, you didn't trust them. You knew they didn't know all the operations, but you would try to train them. I mean, it was not like
right.
outcast, but it was like, don't do nothing unless I tell you to, you know.
Right.
No matter what, don't do nothing.
Right.
Because we don't want you making any mistakes.
Right. And yet at the same time, you also had to tell them what to do.
And you had to tell them, yeah,
uh-huh.
and train them. And then, of course, from the officer's perspective now, it was a little different, you know, because
mm-hmm.
we'd welcome those guys in and we'd try to train them. The biggest thing was a lot of times these guys never even had threw a hand grenade.
Really?
I mean, they'd never, yeah, even they'd thrown the dummies, but never had thrown a live one.
Uh-huh.
So this is the first time this stuff was given to them. And I know we'd bring them in, check their rifles, make sure the rifles could shoot, you know, because they would give them weapons back there and not check them, and there'd be parts missing on the weapons sometimes.
Weapons that had already been used?
They were old weapons, yeah, going back in the rear when they come in country, you know, just mm-hmm. big pools of weapons, and some clerk just says, here's your gun, you know, go.
Right.
And they're not checking them. They didn't give them a chance to shoot them, and they come out to the unit. In a couple cases, you know, the rifles didn't even work. So we'd have to make sure they had a good rifle.
Now, were these M14s at this point?
No, these were M16s.
M16s.
But we'd check them, you know, do test firing, make sure that they would shoot, you know, check the guy out, make sure he knows how to operate. Give him a hand grenade, let him throw a hand grenade or two.
Right. Just to get
a real
idea.
Live one, you know, not on these safe ranges like you have here in the States. This is just throw the thing out there. Of course, they're nervous about that.
Yeah. And you had to kind of bring them along through these circumstances.
And try to, you know, break them in like that, yeah. Take them out on patrol at night, and man, that first night was pretty tough for most of those guys because everything was just new for them, you know.
Right,
but it was like us when we first went in.
Yeah, and they're totally like on alert.
Yeah.
And revved up probably pretty
high. Every little noise, you know, just.
Did you, Frank, observe any problems with the M16s? People have talked about that, and I just wonder if you observed any of that.
No, I'd never experienced. You know, I've heard that too. We encountered problems, but I don't think necessarily because it was M16s. We'd look at them and see part of the thing was, you know, we'd check people's rifles, make sure they work, inspect them, make them clean them.
Right. And make them know how they work. And
we'd stop at the end of the day, usually it was still daylight, you know, rather than pushing right till night.
Mm-hmm.
Stop. Okay, guys, now it's time, you know, there's no contact, clean your weapons. So that's, you know, there's order of business, clean the rifles. You know,
right.
Take care of this stuff. And I didn't personally experience that great failure like I've heard the Marines and everybody else.
Yeah,
had.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was the main thing.
Okay.
When these things got rusty, and sometimes they did, they'd get pretty darn rusty.
Yeah.
I mean, you catch a guy who hadn't cleaned his rifle for several days, I mean, it'd just like be a chunk of rust.
And you had to kind of put the boot to him.
And that's the jobs for the squad leaders in that, to make sure that doesn't happen.
Okay, uh-huh.
Yeah.
But you had to sort of, you know,
right,
also
you have
reinforce.
To remind them. This has to be a daily regimen, you know, like you brush your teeth every day. You clean your rifle, you know.
Right. At some point here, Frank, you were starting to get short, as they say.
Yeah.
Did you have that in your mind?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if I was going to make it. But you try not to think about it.
Okay.
Because you never knew what one day to the next would bring.
Right. You know, some guys, you know, would know exactly and would say 93 days or something like that. And you didn't really do that? You wanted to just kind of go through each day?
No, I didn't do that myself. Uh-huh. Yeah, I just kind of said, when the time comes, the day will come. Yeah.
Okay.
And I'll leave. And then that was hard. I mean, it was like breaking yourself away from a group of men. Because there was, you know, most of us were the original ones. And
right.
And it was kind of hard knowing I'm going home and some of these guys, you know, are still staying here. It made you feel like you're abandoning them.
Yeah, did you have any idea who was going to replace you, or were you just going to be gone and someone else would come?
No, all I knew was, you know, my day, I'm going to leave, and I had no idea who's coming in.
And several guys were going to be leaving with you, I presume.
Yeah, most of us all. If we hadn't, you know, gotten sick or wounded during the year, we'd all be pulling out about the same time.
Okay, and do you...
But, you know, still there were some that came in midterm and everything who you'd worked with for 6 months or so. That
And
knew pretty well, yeah.
Yeah. Did your staff sergeant continue with you the whole time, and was he able to leave with you?
No, some of them got wounded.
Okay, so you had some changes there.
A platoon sergeant made it.
Uh-huh.
And Sergeant Belcher, Jack Belcher. Martin originally, but then once Martin was wounded, then Belcher took over, so he was there with me for about 9 months.
Uh-huh. And was he able to...
Most of the other squad leaders had gotten wounded or rotated out and rotated over. Because, you know, they're right there with the troops.
Yes.
They're out in the midst of all the battles. And
yes, sir.
They're catching all the hard stuff.
When your time actually came to leave, this is your first tour, how did you... what were you looking forward to? Do you remember?
I don't really remember. Because this, you know, this was pretty traumatic. The whole experience was.
Okay. Yeah.
I just knew I was coming out of Vietnam, and I, you know, had no thoughts of the future. Just was coming out alive, and I mean that was more than you could be thankful for.
Yeah. After everything you had seen.
And I mean, I had no real plans. I didn't even know I was going to stay in the Army yet. Matter of fact, at that point, I probably said I'm getting out of the Army because, you know. After what I experienced over there through that combat, I don't know if I want any more of this.
Yes, sir. How many men actually came out with you? How many were from your platoon were able to leave with you?
Well, I don't remember.
Just a handful?
Yeah, very small handful.
Okay. Sir, let's take a break for a moment.
Okay.